Welcome to The Word at Westminster, a podcast with talks, studies, interviews, sermons, and more from Westminster Church in Barrie, Canada. It's about learning and living God's Word.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the special episode of the podcast. And today it's a challenging subject. It is a sensitive subject, but it is a very critical one. And the subject is pornography. And we have a very special guest here today, Sathya Sam, who is an addiction recovery coach, and he has coached men literally from all around the world. He's the host of the Man Within podcast, and he's also the creator of Deep Clean, which is a recovery program. He is a father. He is a husband. He is an author of this book, The Last Relapse. And I've got it here on the shelf. Let me just read the subtitle to you, because a lot of the gold is in the subtitle. Realize Your Potential, Reclaim Intimacy, and Resolve the Root Issues of Porn Addiction. And we'll come back to some of those topics shortly. But just want to say an out-of-the-gate message to people who are watching or maybe listening to this, and maybe this is for yourself. Maybe you're listening or trying to get some information for someone you love and care about. There can be guilt and shame. This is not about that. This is about wholeness. And there is real help and hope for the process. And so this is an honest conversation, and that is what this is all about. So Sathya, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Let's jump right into some of these questions. Porn is the public health crisis that not many people want to name. That's how I would define it. You state that the annual revenue from pornography likely exceeds that of the NBA, NFL, and Netflix, which when you think about those organizations is mind-boggling, and that people are accessing it younger and younger. Could you explain maybe how prevalent and accessible pornography has become, and also maybe if the nature of pornography is changing?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So you hit the nail on the head. Pornography is the three A's. It's affordable, accessible, and anonymous. And that is very unique to any other kind of drug or behavior that people could be addicted to. It has all three and has them in high volumes. And that's what makes it, I would call it exactly what you said, it's a silent epidemic in our society. A lot of headlines go to the age of first exposure. It's a very common subject.
Right.
Because the age of first exposure is declining. You know, it used to be maybe 10 to 12 years old, and now it's reported to be 8 to 10, somewhere in that range. I'm personally not super concerned about the age of first exposure nearly as much as I'm concerned about the volume of access, the volume of content, and the nature of the content they're watching, which you touched on in your question. I think the volume is a huge issue because, you know, my whole, the reason I got into this work is because I have my own 15 years struggle with pornography, growing up in the church, pastor's home, got exposed in my, to pornography in the computer lab of my Christian school, that whole kind of deal.
Right.
And the challenge for me when I was young and I wanted to view pornography was I had to, the house had to be empty, it had to be the right time of day, I had to know how to kind of log in, sometimes there were blockers I had to get around. The right. barriers to entry were there, and it didn't stop me, don't get me wrong. But these days, if the kid has a smartphone and he's in his bedroom, he can have access to everything he wants without any kind of regulation or restriction. And that's what's making this so dangerous, is that the addiction is happening a lot faster. The hardwiring is happening at very key developmental ages. And what compounds the whole issue is the nature of what they're viewing. Some surveys, some studies rather, have suggested that about 80% of mainstream adult content online depicts scenes of violence or aggression towards the woman, typically, in the scene. And so it's not just they're watching bad stuff, but there's some messaging underneath as well. There's some programming there that can be really harmful, especially later on in the adult years when you do want to have, you know, healthy relationships and healthy sexual relationships in a marriage.
Right.
Some of this early exposure can really cause problems there.
And that, and I've heard that a couple different places that, you know, there's, you know, the nature of sexual content is becoming more violent as well. And there's like neurological change that like changes your thinking, is it not?
Yes. Yeah. There's over, you know, there's probably over 500 research studies now that show specific structural changes to the brain. Most of it can be organized into four. It's four structural changes. And I can go into, do you want me to go into them? I don't know if that's helpful.
Whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, I can touch on them really, really quickly, but
maybe kind of high level.
The four changes to the brain are a hypofrontality. So that's reduced access to your prefrontal cortex, which is where you make a lot of your executive decision making. It's where you would delay gratification, think long term, consequence, that sort of thing. The second is sensitization. And so that's when non-sexual things start to trigger you to want, sexual experiences. So for me, when I was struggling with pornography, that was the laptop on my desk open. I'd walk into my room, I'd see the laptop there. It's not a sexual thing, but it would trigger me. The third thing is desensitization, and that's where you see a lot of this tolerance getting built up, especially in young people. So when you're watching such stimulating content at a young age, the threshold for your body to even experience arousal becomes very well, it becomes elevated to the point that then a real life sexual experience is not comparable. It doesn't reach that threshold. And so it's not as stimulating, it's not as exciting, and sometimes it can even lead to, issues in men like erectile dysfunction and that sort of thing. And then the last one is a reduced stress response. And this is very symptomatic of anybody that's dealing with an addiction, is their ability to manage stress is always somehow attached to the behavior. So those things are all problem, but in the context of early exposure, what we found is that sexual stimulation is processed 20% faster in the body than any other kind of stimulation. And so the hardwiring is happening very rapidly. I don't necessarily like the kid being on social media all day. There's hardwiring there that's happening as well. But once they're scrolling through pornography, that hardwiring is happening 20% faster. And so there's a lot going on from a neuroscientific perspective, to be conscious of, and to be well, yeah, especially if you're raising kids, I would say you want to be really conscious of that stuff.
So those who are watching or listening, what you're hearing right now is an indication of some of the stuff you see in the book. So you go pretty deep into things. It's not just like, oh, hey, do this, this, and this, and everything will be fine. You've done so much research and background and have your own experience. And I want to ask about that in the book because one of the things I like is that you go deeper into some of the root issues, and you look at like underlying causes and the reasons we want to look at the pornography. So why is going back to those root issues, why is that so essential for recovery? And let me just say, by the way, before you answer, is this is also helpful people in other areas of your life, because when you kind of go through the book, and I'm sure this the Deep Clean program does this too, but like you're going through root issues and how you think and feel about certain things and maybe things that happened in your past. I'm like, oh, wait a second. That's why I make that financial decision like that. So there are other benefits as well for people in your life. But so why is looking at underlying causes and the reasons we want to look at pornography so essential for recovery?
Well, just to comment on what you said really quick, that was something that surprised me when God called me into this line of work. I was just excited to help people in an area where I myself had experienced some growth and some healing and freedom. What I didn't realize, though, is when somebody does eliminate sexual sin and sexual issues from their lives, multiple areas of their life start to be impacted. Like you said, whether it's financially, one thing is physical fitness. We see that very commonly, and I think there's scriptural evidence for that. He who sins sexually sins against his own body, like it says in 1 Corinthians 6. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit? So a lot of guys quit pornography, and then they start to lift weights or they start to eat better. We had a missionary just message us. He's crossed 2 years freedom from pornography, and since he quit, he's run 1,800 miles. 1,800 miles, including an ultra marathon, something he always wanted to do. But now that he's eliminated sexual sin from his life, he has a better value for his body. He's taking better care of it, and he's obviously more motivated to do some of those things. So I just want to comment on that. It is a big deal what you're talking about. And I think when you do get to the root of the issue, you really end up touching all areas of your life. Proverbs 4:23 says, "Guard your heart above all else, for from it flow the issues of life." And so there's a secret embedded in that verse, which is that the issues of our lives, the things that we experience that are visible and tangible, actually have a basis in the heart of the individual. And so a lot of times the conversation around, if you don't want to watch pornography, the conversation is install an internet filter, get covenant eyes, get an accountability partner, confess your sins, all good things. Oftentimes they are very surface level. They're not necessarily getting to the heart of the matter. It's kind of like running over a weed with a lawnmower, which I talk about in the book. And we all know that if you really want a weed to never grow back again, you have to uproot it. And I only know this because for the first 3 years that I was earnestly trying to quit pornography, I did the internet filters. accountability partners. I went to groups, courses,
Right.
seminars, street counting, willpower, deliverance prayer. I it was not from a lack of effort, but
Yeah.
ultimately all of my efforts were channeled towards a surface level solution, and I got surface level results because of it. So I the whole message of this really is, if you can get to the roots of it, if you can get to the heart of the matter, not only can you eliminate something from your life short term, you can actually permanently remove it, and other areas of your life can also be positively affected as well. And that's why when you do eliminate sexual sin, often you will see guys, in addition to the stuff I just mentioned, like working out and that kind of thing,
Yeah.
you'll see guys start that ministry they always wanted to do, or volunteer at their church because they finally feel like they can do it without feeling like a hypocrite. Or they start that business, they advance in their careers.
Yeah.
A lot happens for people on a purpose level when they eliminate sexual sin from their lives.
Wow. We're going to come back to purpose because that's a huge part of the book and a huge part of your approach. But
Absolutely.
when getting in some of the underlying issues, why some people have a desire to consume pornography. You talk about intimacy, and I think this fits very well with what you just said. It's as if porn is this short-term fix, and then for some sort of intimacy issue, then people use it as an outlet, feel bad, commit to stopping, just do it again. And you quote one of your teachers, I think it was in seminary, he says, kind of connected the word intimacy with into me see,
That's
which I thought
right.
was really good. So how does all of that figure into pornography use and even recovery?
Yeah, I think people are surprised to hear about this
Yeah.
sometimes, but well, God has hardwired us for connection. We are designed for connection, not just with God,
Yeah.
although that's obviously the most important relationship of all, but also relationship with each other. And the problem with connection is that we need it. We need connection. Intimacy being a deeper, more personal form of connection. And when something is so fundamental, you will get that need met. The question is how. And what we often don't realize is pornography is fast food intimacy. Anybody who's struggling with pornography or sexual sin is actually experiencing an intimacy disorder or an intimacy issue. And the fastest way to heal from these kind of intimacy issues is to learn how to experience healthy intimacy in your relationships with the people around you and with the living God. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it. If you think about what pornography offers you, in addition to pleasure, you're getting the experience of a connection. Now, mind you, it's not a real connection, it's that fast food connection, but it's connection nonetheless. Why do people like listening to a podcast like the conversation we're having? People like to insert themselves into the conversation. Of course, they learn and they grow, and hopefully by the end of today you have some actionable things if you're struggling. We're going to accomplish all that. But the real reason people actually keep coming back to a podcast is they relate that so much so they can insert themselves into the media they're consuming. Pornography is no different. Guys insert themselves into those situations. When women are watching, they insert themselves into the situation, imagine what it's like. And that it's that connection, it's that need for connection that's actually driving them. They did a study in North Carolina, it's the eye test study, and they basically, sorry, not eye test, it was eye tracking. So they tracked where do people's eyes go when they view pornography. And they found there were two places in particular. The first was the male genitalia, and the second was the face of the woman. Not even the body, the face. And so it just goes to show you how much connection is actually driving even something that seems so raw, physical, sexual kind of desire. There's a need for connection underneath that's driving a lot of this. And so that's why community is so powerful, fellowship is so powerful. Your small group can be really powerful and really healing if it's the right group, because healthy connection satisfies the heart, and a satisfied heart rarely wanders for things like pornography and the other lusts of the flesh.
I wonder if the prevalence and rise of the internet, like it's so prevalent in smartphones and digital media and everything else, has become so prevalent. But there really is a, almost the term social media is misleading because it's not really social. It is to a degree, but it's not real. It's a substitute for something deeper. So would you say
Yeah.
that the rise of the internet and more and more people are isolated, they're living, quote unquote, online, doing these sorts of things, has that kind of maybe accelerated a need for an outlet, socially a connection, but it's not even a healthy one?
100%. Yeah, I think loneliness is on the rise. The
Yeah.
amount of guys in our community that ask me, how do you deal with loneliness? or how do I plug into my community? I don't know how to do that. I don't even know where I would do that. Is rampant. Like it's very, very prevalent. And I do think you're right. Social media has kind of created the illusion that we're connected and we know so many people and look at how many followers I have. And even that's very misleading. Like people are always very impressed by our Instagram account. We have a fairly large following. But for me, I'm like, it doesn't, it's not the same as discipling someone. I was a local church pastor for almost 10 years before God called me to do this. And sometimes I miss those days of just one-on-one coffees with guys, having those conversations, talking it through. There's nothing like it. And so, I do think we're more starved for real connection. And I think it's also why, on the flip side, having meaningful relationships in your life, and you don't need a lot. I don't know if you know who John Eldridge is, but I interviewed John Eldridge on my podcast recently. He wrote a book called Wild at Heart about 20 years ago. That was really helped a lot of, I think, Christian men understand kind of the Christian male experience in our world. And something that he said that really stuck with me is he said, guys, girl, women connect in circles, right? There's social circles, there's groups, there's different communities. And he said, it's not that guys aren't communal as well, but guys, first and foremost, really just need one to two really solid relationships. And that alone can be enough for a guy to stay on the straight and narrow, to make good decisions, and to reach out for some help when he needs it. And we've witnessed that in our community. When people join our community, they form friendships, they form bonds. Usually it's just a couple guys that they'll connect with. Sometimes those friendships last a lifetime, but they're really healing. And there's something about the heart being connected to other people that really can lower your appetite for things like pornography or some of those other vices that entangle us.
I've heard that before about male friendship and how it's kind of like a, I don't want to overuse the word crisis, but there's really a lack of kind of an understanding and cultivation or encouragement of men creating bonds and good quality friendships. And it's almost our culture has become so hypersexualized. Like if you have a close male friend, they're like, oh, something's going on there. Well, no, it's like we've lost this capacity to cultivate and have a real friendship with someone that is not sexual in nature, but it can still be intimate in a friend kind of way.
Yes. Oh, yeah, 100%.
So I'm a very practical person. I know you are too. Your phrase "actionable steps" tells me that that is so. I liked your discussion about macro behavior making being made up of micro behaviors and habits. So that's very helpful. Can you explain what those things are and how they relate to this?
Definitely. I think again, this kind of taps back to my pastoral experience before I started Deep Clean. Guys would come up to me and say, I'm struggling with pornography. It's a macro behavior. And so we naturally think, well, okay, then how do we help you quit pornography? And that's, you install Covenant on Eyes or you join an accountability group or whatever. But if I followed somebody who was struggling, and not that I would actually do this, but if I did follow them around, what we would start to identify is watching pornography or struggling with sexual sin is sort of the macro. It's the big behavior. It's the thing that we're most conscious of.
Up
But
here.
if you break it down, there's actually smaller behaviors that lead to it. Maybe it's some dead scrolling on social media. Maybe it's I get into an argument with my wife. Maybe it's trying to hit a deadline at work. There's often these repeated rituals that are much smaller, seemingly unrelated behaviors that actually are the lead up to the big relapse or binge or struggle with pornography. And so when you can kind of break down a macro behavior into micro behaviors, it allows you to get a little bit more upstream, and it actually allows you to control the more impactful parts of your struggle. Because the most common question I get on Instagram, we're very active with our messages there. We get tons of messages every single day is, how do I handle temptation better? And what they're basically saying is, the next time I'm tempted, how do I make sure that I don't give in? And what I would like to suggest is, let's ask a better question, which is, how do you become tempted less frequently? And if we can answer that question and maybe identify some micro behaviors that lead to those more heated moments, I think we can maybe we I'm not saying we can eliminate temptation, and that's not the goal, because Jesus himself was tempted in every way, but he was without sin. And so I think and he also did instruct us to pray, lead us not into temptation. So I do think we should definitely try to reduce it, and more importantly, probably just gain better control of our own desires and those moments when we are tempted. And I think the way you do that is by parsing out the micro behaviors that are leading to that big macro behavior you're trying to quit.
From all the people you interact with, are there some common micro behaviors that you see? Wow, these five things keep coming up time and time again. And when people can identify that, be honest about that, they're going to have more success.
Yes. So there's lots of them that come up frequently. But I could probably list 8 or 10 right now, but there's one that stands out above them all, and it's going to bed at night. You like the most common time to view pornography is between 10 at night and midnight. So I tell guys, okay, well, yeah, so there's that stat, and then 91% of all porn viewership happens on the mobile device. So if you charge your phone outside of your bedroom at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., you literally, just statistically speaking, will set yourself up for a better night of sleep. And so a lot of guys are, they ask, like, because I get tempted at night. I end up scrolling on my phone at night. It starts innocently. I check out a couple of messages. That leads to checking something on Instagram. That leads to scrolling, which leads to, we all kind of know that path. But the biggest thing, like the biggest micro behavior, would just be coming up with a nighttime routine so that you're consistently going to bed at the same time and that your phone is getting charged outside of your bedroom. You do those two things and you are well on your way to setting yourself up for success and maybe fighting some of the more real issues. But that's a really good place to start.
Wow, that's really great. So you bring in faith throughout the whole book, and the Deep Clean program. Can you say a specific word to men about the importance of biblical practices, whether that's daily or weekly, in the well-being, well-being and godliness? Because I think this is just my sense. Maybe people kind of they parse things out and they put things in different categories. What is the power and importance of those kind of practices?
It's quintessential. There's no other way to say it. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, right? Pornography addiction is really an intimacy disorder. And it is very important that we connect with our brothers. It's important that we're connected to our spouse. But above all, it's so important that we connect with God. And one thing that we teach a lot of people in our community is you don't do spiritual disciplines to check a box or, whatever. It's not about just doing it because you did it. Excuse me. It's about doing it to connect with God. And in the process of, reading your Bible every single day, I do a 24-hour fast every single week. I've been doing that for years, since 2017. Having some of these spiritual practices in place allow you to just get steady, regular touch points with God. The only person in the world who can actually give you the strength to walk in integrity and walk in freedom anyway. And so I think I really encourage people, don't feel like you have to do everything. I'm the most concerned about people who try to do everything at once. I would much rather somebody who's like, I can't find time for God in the day. I don't know when to do it. I'd much rather that person just start with 5 minutes a day and just build on it. And I was actually running a coaching call this morning, and I was telling my clients this: when it comes to like scheduling out your priorities, it's better to just do a little bit than every single day than to try to do a lot in bursts. And I think your relationship with God is no exception to that. And I will say that with our clients who def not necessarily our clients who get the best outcomes initially, but the best clients who get the best outcomes long term, they're all very diligent in their connection with God. And it looks, for some people they go out in nature and they pray. For some people they're up in the morning, they're reading the Bible. It looks different. But the point is that they have something that they're really intentional about. And I think for sustainability and longevity in walking in freedom and walking in integrity, you're not going to experience anything more powerful than connecting with God.
Let me ask you about fasting because, I'm preparing a bit for something else on fasting right now, but there's,
Oh, cool.
I feel like it is the It is the, it comes up so often as a spiritual discipline. Jesus did it. Paul talks about it. But it's probably the least favorite for a lot of people. Why, that's my guess.
Definitely.
Why did that connect specifically with you? Why has that been so helpful as a part of your own journey?
It came out of reading a story in the Gospels where the disciples try to cast out a demon and they can't. And so they bring the demonized man to Jesus. He casts it out and they say, "Why weren't we able to do that?" And he says, "This can only come up by prayer and fasting." So there's an implication there, which is that the disciples were not fasting and Jesus was, or Jesus had been at least fasting on enough of a regular basis that he had that power and authority. And so I've always loved the idea of fasting as a lifestyle. And not that I'm against doing, a 3-day fast or those more extended fasts, sporadically as God calls you. Nothing wrong with that at all. I just wanted to have a baseline. And the thing that I found over the years, Matt, is that there's certain things that you experience through each of the spiritual disciplines that are very unique. Like praying with God, there's certain things you experience praying to God and praying with Him and having that dialogue that you just can't experience from reading the Bible. And there's certain things you experience from reading the Bible that you just can't experience praying. And there's certain things that you experience fasting, starving yourself of something, using those hunger pains to remind you. I personally use the hunger pains to remind me to pray. I always pray into something very specific. I have something I'm focused on for that week, or something that God will maybe place on my heart. There's just certain things you get fasting that you don't get any other way. And I'm always amazed by this because sometimes I want to talk myself out of fasting for the reasons you said, because it's not a very enjoyable spiritual discipline. And the thing that keeps me committed to fasting, and I'm not perfect every week. I probably do about, I would say, 40 to 45 weeks of the year. I get that 24-hour fast in. The thing that keeps me tethered to it is when I look back and I think most of the biggest growth points for me, the areas where I've matured the most, the things where God has had the greatest breakthroughs in my life, have all been things that I fasted and prayed over. So th there's something about that regular practice of fasting for me that's been really, really, really valuable, really impactful.
You talk a lot about knowing your purpose in life. That figures in the kind of that, you mentioned it earlier as a part of the stacks, and then you kind of, encourage people to flesh it out, and I think the workbook helps with this too. How does that figure into recovery, your purpose in life?
Yeah, this is a bit of an interesting one. And I think there's scripture to back this up, and I think there's data. I'll start with the data. They did a study. They had over 3,000 participants in this study, and they call it a multivariate analysis. So what they're trying to do is compare a bunch of variables to see how it affects one thing. And so tons of variables to see which of these has the greatest predictor of whether or not somebody would watch pornography. And what they found is that above them all, there was one that stood out again and again, and it was meaninglessness. When people felt aimless or meaningless in life, they were much more likely to view porn. So it's a bit of a strange thing, but I think it makes sense. And I don't know what you think about this gentleman, but I'll just mention his name because he gave a little tidbit that was very helpful, even though he's controversial. Jordan Peterson used to work with people that were addicted and that had addictions. And I was at one of his events, and he said something that just kind of struck me, just kind of caught me off guard. But he said the main reason people quit an addiction is because they find something better to do. They find something better to do. And I don't have the full explanation for it, but I just know that when men are on purpose, when people believe that their life has meaning and that the things they're doing actually make the world a better place, something that's bigger than themselves, they just tend to not go towards those things that could pull them away. And so in theory, find your purpose and you'll quit. But I think the other side that I've seen is when people really focus on tackling the root issues like we've been talking about today, going through a little bit of a journey to really become that person that God's made them to be, in the process, a natural byproduct is they just discover their purpose, or they rediscover an old purpose that got buried under their baggage and their sin. So that's one of my favorite things, is seeing what our clients do after they're done with us, whether it is to start that business or start the ministry, or sometimes it's just, they show up more at home. They found more purpose at home. They're able to connect with their kids more meaningfully again. But it's a really beautiful thing. And I think scripturally, we know that God has designed us. We're fearfully and wonderfully made with a unique purpose. And we know that it's sin that entangles us, as the writer wrote in Hebrews, it's the sin that entangles us. And so I think naturally, when you do get set free of sin, you're able to run the race and you're able to run after the things that God has uniquely designed you for.
Well, that's good. What you see reminds me of T.S. Eliot, the writer, had this line. I forget one of his plays, I'm sure, but the end is where you start from. And that's always stuck with me, meaning the end, like the end purpose. You start there and work backwards. How am I making decisions, how I make priorities that kind of feed towards that bigger goal.
Powerful.
And so I would say people listening or watching this that this was helpful for me. Like, I'm a pretty focused person. I know what my purpose is, but you kind of encouraged us to kind of write it down in a concise, memorable way, something that you can remember. Mine's still a bit too long. I'm working it down a bit more. I can remember it, but I have to memorize a lot of things, so I'm used to it. But it's a really
Yeah,
helpful
fair.
process too, because that also can't help but influence in a positive way other aspects of your life. And it makes you think about, okay, who am I as a spouse, as a father? Who am I in my professional life? Who am I amongst my friends? Am I living in, who am I when no one else is watching?
Yeah.
And how does that feed in? So just even an awareness, bringing it to the top of mind. Oh, right. I've spent time, I've invested time, which means it's valuable. I care about the outcome, and it's kind of worked backwards. So I think, again, folks, that's a really, really helpful benefit to the book. Yeah, and I think Peterson's got a lot of great things to say for sure.
Yeah.
Some people are listening to this and they want help, and maybe they feel shame and guilt. What kind of word would you say to them about kind of a next step to that person?
I mean, yeah, the first thing I would say is I get it. I struggled, like I mentioned, I struggled as a pastor. I know exactly what it's like to live in that shame. The ultimate message of shame is to hide. And so I think the best thing you can do is somehow bring this to the light. The dark things must come to light. Scripture says in it's Proverbs 20:13, he who conceals a sin will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find mercy. And I think there's something really beautiful about us bringing the dark things to light. I think God honors it, and I think God always meets us with mercy for where we're at. And so I think if you're, if nobody knows about what's going on, I think one of the best things you can do is even just plug into resources like you've done. You read the book, and there's a free workbook that comes with it. You're listening to this podcast. It's really great. So you've already taken a step in the right direction to somebody who's, listening or watching. What would that next step be? Maybe it's just talking to somebody you trust. It's a pastor or a leader. Maybe it's a friend that is not going to judge you. We have a free community online. We love when guys join there. If you have nowhere else, join our online community. It's a chance for people to interact with other people that are on the same journey, that want to become the person God's made them to be, and want to walk in this. And you'll find out very quickly. It's the number one piece of feedback we get when guys join the community. I thought I was the only one. I had no idea there were other guys going through exactly what I'm going through in my marriage or in my job or in my specific struggle. And so I think that's how you de-shame is you bring the dark things to light with other people. But it doesn't have to be everybody. In fact, it shouldn't be everybody. You want to find the right people who are going to be able to support you along the way.
What is the greatest joy that you've experienced in putting this whole process together and working with people?
Oh, I haven't been asked that question in a long time. I think on if I'm being honest, there's two. I think one is the purpose part that we just talked about a minute ago. I think it really upsets me to see people not walking in their purpose, and there is some anger underneath what I do, as in I'm upset that this kind of agenda of the enemy has wreaked so much havoc on people's lives, and it's all the more reason for me to help them eliminate it, because I know when you eliminate these sins from your life, you're unchained, you're unleashed, and God can do incredible things through you. I think the more rewarding thing at an even deeper level, though, is seeing the relationships restored. It's seeing somebody get their marriage back on track. It's seeing somebody show up for their kids again. We had one guy, he's a really high level finance guy, and he was so impacted by some of our tools. We have one tool called the Feel Wheel, which you went through the book, so you would have heard me talk about it. And it's not my tool. Somebody else created it, but we're just big fans of it. But he was so impacted. Nobody had ever taught him to how to like label emotions and stuff. He was so impacted by it, he printed it out and he put it on the wall in their dining room. And every night when he would have dinner with his kids, he would say, "Okay, kids, what were some of the main feelings that you felt today?" And he talked them through it. And those kinds of stories just melt me, because not only is he a better father, but he's also changed the entire lineage. The entire trajectory is going to look completely different because he got this out of his life, and now he's able to help his kids build skills that are going to help them make better emotional decisions, and obviously better decisions sexually as well. So that's what makes this whole thing so worth it.
Well, you say, on that, you say that the greatest void in men's health is emotional self-awareness. So maybe I thought that was really helpful too. And I think sometimes men use an excuse like, "Oh, I'm a man. I just don't talk about my feelings, or men don't cry, all that stuff." And we're like, "Oh, men cry," but we still really, in a functional level, and many times, kind of suppress emotions or feelings or don't do that. So, but you encourage people, "Hey, we got to talk about this stuff, because if you don't, as you say, bad things happen in the dark."
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you and I are both in, we're both in Ontario, Canada. I don't know if you're a Leaf fan or not, but I'm diehard over here.
Yes.
Okay,
Oh yeah,
nice.
big
All
time.
right.
Yeah, you're among friends.
Beautiful. Perfect. Okay, we both need blue and white. Great. So, it hasn't happened in our lifetimes, but we're as Leaf fans, we're dreaming
This
of
year,
the
man.
one day. The one day that they get to raise Lord Stanley over their head, they get to win they win the Stanley Cup. Now, anybody who thinks that men aren't emotional has clearly never watched somebody lift the Stanley Cup over their head, because that is the loudest yell or roar of excitement that you will ever see somebody experience. We are absolutely emotional. I think it's I don't think any guy would really argue that if you kind of pushed hard enough. I think the main issue is that guys are only permitted to experience excitement, like winning a championship, and anger. Those are the two that seem to be socially acceptable, and everything else kind of is feminine, or it's not manly, and it's to be ignored. And so I think when we work with guys, we don't necessarily say you have to feel a certain emotion. That wouldn't really make any sense. But what we just do is give them permission to experience emotions beyond happiness and anger. And I think in the process of developing that ability to understand what you're feeling, number one, you become way more powerful. Because if you are uncomfortable with sadness and with some of those other emotions, you will shelf them, and you actually become very afraid of them. You push them away. So it's a much more powerful place to be able to say, no matter what I experience, I have the skill set and the capacity to handle it. But number two, that's always going to lead to better relationships. It's always going to lead to better decision making. And all of those fundamental things we're talking about that actually lead to making good decisions in life and avoiding sexual sin, most of them start with the man better managing his emotional life.
Wow, that's really good. Thank you. Before we close this out, any how can people connect with you? Website, the book we've talked about, and I'll put those links in the notes to the show. But do you want to share anything about where you are, kind of some of the things that you're doing that people should know about?
I think the book is a great place for people to start. We donate all of our profits from that book to a charity in Uganda. There it is, for those of
There
you
it
watching, The
is.
Last Relapse, it's called. But for people that, if you just want a digital copy, you can get it at thelastrelapsebook.com for free. We just need an email to know where to send it. And when you do give us your email, we will also send you a link to join the community. Only if you want, no pressure. You can go through the book on your own, regardless of where you're at. But those would be the best places to start. And then I have a podcast as well called The Man Within. And so if you're a podcast listener, which obviously you are if you made it this far into the interview, you can go and check that out as well. So The Man Within is the podcast, and thelastrelapsebook.com is where you can get your free copy.
Thank you, and I'll put the and make sure that the logo for the podcast is up there so people can find it quickly. But man, you produce a lot of content. I thought I produced a lot of content. You did too. So, but it's great because a lot of this little things that come up, that little questions people have, you address on that. So you not only have little topical things, but you have interviews as well, which is great. So, Cynthia, thank you so much for taking this time. I'm going to end with a quote in a second, but I appreciate your work, the book, and it takes courage. To be in this space and to write, and you have that, and you have shared honestly and openly. You've done research. You're clearly, rooted in the word, and I just appreciate that, and I know other people do. So thank you.
Oh, thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Here's a final word. These are two quotes from the book. The battle for the mind is not optional. It is for all. You have a mind, therefore you have a battle. If you do not fight in the battle, catastrophes result. You cannot exchange your mind for someone else's. You cannot choose to fight some days and take it easy other days. The battle of the mind is an open invitation, and it will only end when you breathe your last. And finally, with heaven on your side and a proven system, it is hard to not get the results you want.